Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Greenfield-Feig. On this week's episode, I have the privilege of speaking with Sarah Callen, Animal Rescue Program Manager at Mystic Aquarium. On this episode, Sarah will be discussing the logistics behind completing large whale necropsies, and she highlights a great release story about Schubert the seal, who was released after being rehabilitated at Mystic Aquarium. So let's get started. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Thanks, Michelle. It's so great to be here and get a chance to talk to you and see you again.
I know, it's great. We met when I was doing an externship at Mystic, and between all the dolphin necropsies and the one humpback whale we did, I said, we have to get you on to talk about what it's like doing stranding response and rehab in the Northeast. So I'm super excited to hear what you have to say today.
It's great to be here. And I think your externship was full of all different types of responses, which definitely illustrates the variability in the stranding field.
And that's exactly what we're going to get into today. Before we get there, can you share with our listeners an experience that really helped shape where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. I started out my career in the training field, working with endangered Hawaiian monk seals. And through that opportunity, I ended up going out to the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands through NOAA's Hawaiian Monk Seal Health and Disease Program. I spent 4 months on an uninhabited island called Laysan Island. I believe Michelle Barbieri was on one of your other podcasts. It was under her direction. On this island, I always imagined you're in paradise, and I was very excited to get out there and to see all these animals and their natural habitat. And so one thing that was really shocking and a surprise to me was how much marine debris was out there. And you're just absolutely surrounded by marine debris from all over the world. These animals were all directly affected by it, and they're so far away from any form of civilization. Our role out there was to help the population and do population surveys and counts. And a lot of our job ended up being disentanglements for these animals. And albatross were ingesting anything from scissors to lighters and toothbrushes, kids' figurines, anything plastic could end up in their stomach. I really wanted to make sure that I could be a voice for these animals in some capacity and have a platform to educate the public, but also help the animals at the same time. So, you know, the job opened up at Mystic, and it was really the perfect dream job where I was able to work directly in rehabilitating and responding to these animals in the field, and then also have the platform where we educate the public and get to essentially be a voice for the animals and explain what's going on in the environment and how it's affecting them and what we can do to help mitigate those threats.
Wow. I ask this question to a lot of folks, and you know, I'm always amazed, but I honestly have goosebumps right now. It's so inspiring. I'd love for you to talk a little bit more. What does your educational program look like, and how are you working with the public to raise awareness about these important ideas?
Sure. Every animal that comes into our rehab program tells us something directly about what's going on in the environment. And so we will share that animal's story. So we have docents that stand outside of our clinic, and those docents will explain to people what animals we have in our rehabilitation at the moment, what they came in for, and also talk about ways that people can help the environment. And then we actually have many events throughout the year where we'll do beach cleanups and collaborate with other organizations in the local community. We have with our program over 350 first responder volunteers. Essentially, anytime you go out on a stranding response, you're going out there to assess an animal's health, but you're also going out there and interacting with people on the beach. So what a great educational opportunity when you are on the beach and you're talking with the public. And one of the main things that I think it's important for people to realize is that all the animals we respond to are protected. So keeping a distance from them is really important. And so it's a great way for our responders to be out there to ensure not only are the public safe, but they're keeping the animal safe as well. And then we have a 24-hour hotline. We call every single person back that calls our hotline, which can be very busy sometimes. I think it's really important that we do call people back because that's another way to engage with people and help educate the public. So there's lots of different avenues we take for that, which is fun because it's all very different.
It's different. It's exciting having manned those hotlines. I know how it's so important for people to know that their voice will be heard. There is an animal who's injured or who needs help. So that's really great on you and your entire team.
Thanks. We find it very important to make that connection with the public.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of variation in stranding response for any type of marine mammal. So let's start by talking about large whales. What does that look like from when you get a call that there's a large whale, such as the humpback that we worked on together? What happens from there?
Great question. There is this misconception that when people call the hotline, we can just fix the situation immediately, which unfortunately is typically not the case. It does take time. And I will say that on average, it may take anywhere from 2 to 4 days for us to even get all the logistics together to actually go out to a whale for a necropsy. The one that you came on was one of those where it was very challenging. Part of our coverage area is an island called Block Island, and humpback whales do strand on there from time to time. Logistics working on an island can always add even more challenges to a very complicated situation. And safety is always a priority for any type of response we go on. Things that we have to look at are, what are the weather conditions that we're going to be working under? What are the tides that we have to work with? Because they can fluctuate drastically. I did a whale necropsy about a week ago where we had only an hour and a half to work with before the tide was going to completely cover the beach and we weren't going to be able to get off the beach. So you want to make sure that you have plenty of personnel, because conducting a whale necropsy is very physically demanding. And there are a lot of different roles that come into play between sampling an animal and cutting, and we have runners and photographers and scribes. So there's a lot of logistics and personnel to coordinate, but we actually work very closely with a lot of our partners in our network, which is really helpful. We do rely heavily on large machinery as well, which makes a huge difference. It basically will cut the necropsy time in half if you do have that large machinery.
And for those of you listening who've maybe never seen or participated in a large whale necropsy, when we're saying large machinery, we're talking like actual backhoes and
excavators. Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty intense when you show up and you see these giant trucks on the beach. And it makes it a lot harder unless you have the help of these very serious machines to get you into those internal organs.
Absolutely. Yeah, it can take at least a day or two if you didn't have the heavy machinery. And when you're trying to get the best data you could possibly collect and the most viable tissue samples, you're going to want to get into the internal body as quick as possible. And we've actually had a lot of success and have gotten some amazing samples that have really built a case for the animal. And that's one interesting thing about whale necropsies. It's kind of like this investigation. You're trying to figure out all different clues as to what might have happened to help support the tissue samples you send off to the pathologist. And so you look for things like, is there any signs of blunt force trauma with any hemorrhaging in any of the muscle or blubber? And then you can use that information combined with, did the animal have a full stomach of food? And what's their body condition like? Do they have a thick blubber layer? Is it thin blubber layer? And then all those things combined can really help build your case. So if an animal has a very good blubber layer and it's got a full stomach of food and it was obviously actively eating at the time of death, we can probably suspect that it was an acute death, so a very quick death, wasn't suffering from any chronic illness or anything like that. And so we can then use those clues to tell that animal story and see if there are ways that we can change regulations or different permitting in an area to help keep whales safe. If it's an area where maybe there's a lot of vessel strike cases, we can help change shipping routes. All the data is really important, and especially because there is an unusual mortality event declared for three species of whales that we see in our coverage area: the humpback whale, the minke whale, and the North Atlantic right whale.
Vessel strikes are also a really important issue, as well as entanglements. So other than you can visually see a net around a whale, what are some of those other key identifying features that can help you categorize those two as well?
Yes, that's actually a great question. So sometimes if you're looking at the animal externally, we might not see anything obvious for a blunt force trauma case, but we may occasionally also see some propeller wounds on there, lesions externally. Typically, it's on the dorsal aspect of the animal. And for any sort of entanglement case, we may see impressions on the external surface. And if we do see some impressions, then we're going to want to make sure that we not only measure the width of those impressions, but any distance between multiple impressions on the animal, because that could really help us hone in on what type of gear that animal might have been entangled in or interacted with. It's obviously very sad, but it's fun because the organs aren't where you would expect them to be depending on how decomposed the animal is, because gas builds up and then the organs are going to go to the path of least resistance, which is towards the mouth. So the necropsy I did the other day, the intestines were up near the thorax and we had stuff all over the place. So knowing and learning what organs are supposed to look like and learning what they also look like when they're autolyzed and decomposed really helps to identify, because sometimes you look at something and be like, I know this is an organ, but I'm not sure which one it is because it's just so autolyzed.
Yeah. You know, that's why even in vet school, we do so many necropsies and spend an entire rotation on the pathology floor, because the more things that we can see are normal or not normal, eventually when we have this whale and the liver, it's like kind of red, but it's got all these white spots on it. And that doesn't seem normal, but I don't really know what it is. You take your sample, you go look it up later, but let's follow up on this.
Yeah, exactly. Knowing that comparison and just knowing that something isn't looking normal is helpful in itself. I go to every single whale necropsy and I learn something new every time, which is what I love about this job too. And they're very, very important tools in this field for sure.
Absolutely. So you've got this giant whale in front of you. What exactly do you do with the body after you're done with your necropsy?
Excellent question. We do have a couple options, but our preferred method of disposal is actually burying the carcass on the beach, which takes people by surprise sometimes, but we never have any issues with doing that. Another option could be towing the carcass out to sea and sinking it, but it is really difficult to sink a whale sometimes. And the one time I did try to do that, the whale ended up washing right back on the beach. So the preferred method is definitely burying the carcass, and you would never even be able to tell afterwards that a whale is under there, but we do have to dig a very deep hole. And so that's why having that heavy machinery is helpful for us during the necropsy, but afterwards with the disposal aspect of a necropsy. And we do have to dig a very deep hole well above the high tide line. And one of the main things that we have to ensure during a necropsy is the public are safe and also we are safe. Accidentally stepping into a large hole like that would not be ideal. And so we have a safety officer. And for any whale necropsy, we use something called the Incident Command System, ICS structure. And so basically like a universal language for large scale natural events or disasters and stuff like that. So we use the ICS structure for any type of large scale event that we have. And we've actually used it even for something as small as a release that we have, which is great because people know the structure and they will just look for their role and they know who they have to talk to. So it's all laid out. Everything's very organized. For example, the whale that we just did in New Jersey, we are using the ICS structure and we had over three different stranding organizations involved. We had police officers, so many personnel, and we didn't really have a big meeting beforehand. We had like a quick briefing, but when everyone got to the briefing, they already had the action plan emailed to them prior and we were able to just hit the ground running. And it was so successful. We had an hour and a half time. So yeah, anyone looking to get into this field, there's two free incident command system courses that are available online. And it's ICS 100 and ICS 200, which I highly recommend taking because it's used universally throughout the entire network and nation.
Yeah, those courses sound fantastic. I know I'll be taking them and hopefully others listening who are interested in this field or maybe already in this field can take them as well. So let's transition now to talking about some of the live rescue work you do. So what does it look like to go out on a live pinniped rescue?
So pinniped rescues are probably our most frequent response. We do have over 350 first responder volunteers with our program, which are really important because a lot of stranding organizations aren't going to have a lot of staff. We rely heavily on volunteers. So the process that typically plays out is when we get a hotline call about a seal, we'll send a first responder to the location that the animal was reported in, and they will basically be eyes for us out in the field. And so they're going to report back to us what they're seeing. Does it have labor breathing? Does it appear to be in any respiratory distress? If it's yawning or vocalizing, can you take a look in the mouth and see if the gums are nice and pink? Is there any discharge coming from the eyes, from the nares? Are there any lesions or wounds? Anything abnormal that they see? And then they're also going to let us know how alert the animal is. And We use an acronym BAR, which stands for Bright, Alert, and Responsive. And then we also use QAR, Quiet, Alert, and Responsive. And then you can have a non-responsive animal as well, which isn't a good sign. We'll basically take all that information. We'll do a little health assessment virtually from the aquarium. And then a couple options. We can either leave an animal in the field if they look like they're healthy, and we will have a responder monitoring them if it's a busy area and keeping people at a distance. If it's a really remote area, we're going to just have responders maybe check in on the animal once or twice throughout the day and see if their behavior and health appears to be status quo or if it's declining. And then if it is an animal that does need to come in for rehab, our team will be dispatched and go out there to collect the animal. And they're usually juveniles or weanlings. So we'll pick up an animal in a dog kennel and then transport it back to the aquarium. And when it arrives to the aquarium, it's going to get a full exam, and we're going to check over the whole animal externally, and then we're going to run some other diagnostic tests, and we'll draw blood. We will take x-rays of the animal, and then if we feel like there's a chance there could be internal bleeding or a need to do an ultrasound, we will do that as well. And then from that information, our veterinarians will prescribe a treatment, which is different for every animal that comes through the door. So they'll get an individualized treatment plan. We get lots of different types of cases in the clinic. We see everything from pneumonia. I'd say that's probably our most common thing that animals come in with. We do see various injuries or wounds. More frequently had a lot of entanglements in our area. On average, I'd say seals stay with us for about 3 months. And the goal for every one of them is to get them back home where they belong. And then if they ever couldn't get released, for various reasons, we've had seals that have come in with different eye issues. So if it affects their survival and they wouldn't survive out there, then we would work with NOAA to find some permanent placement in managed care settings for them.
And so these are wild animals that we're ideally hoping to successfully return back to the wild. So when you're talking about these diagnostics that you're doing, you're taking blood, you're giving medications, how are you managing to do all of those things while still maintaining the wild nature of these animals?
So for any sort of diagnostic test we're going to do, we have to physically restrain the animal, and that is for the animal's safety and it's for our safety. We train all of our volunteers on the physical restraint technique. And then when an animal is in rehabilitation with us, we really try to limit any eye contact with them. We feed all of our seals fish from behind a tarp that's around the pools, or we have sliding doors. I joke with our volunteers and interns that they have to have good throwing practice before they come with us, because to our seals, fish essentially falls from the sky because we toss the fish over these tarps for them. And the only time we handle them are when we're in a unit with them collecting blood or doing something like that. And all of our seals will receive physical exams on a weekly basis or biweekly basis, depending on their health status and the needs. We will also occasionally satellite tag some of our seals. Right now, we're trying to satellite tag all of our seals that we release, gray seals in particular, to learn where they're going, where the population's distributed, and being able to track their movements and any patterns or trends and basically see where they go. I don't know if you heard about Schubert, the seal, recently.
I was going to say, I was like, do you want to highlight Schubert?
I would love nothing more than to highlight our national superstar. Yes. Oh boy, Schubert's case is such a unique one, but essentially, 4-year-old gray seal had to have everything aligned perfectly in terms of the tides and a dam being open, but he went through a very long tunnel into a dam, up a dam, and over a dam into a pond. And then he decided to go from that small pond up into a bigger pond just further inland, which was in Beverly, Massachusetts, and kind of more of a built up area with a big mall and lots of shops near a big highway. So just not the safest area for a seal to be. You can also imagine folks who live in this community were very shocked to see a seal in a pond right next to a big mall. So they notified the stranding hotline over there, and the seal was monitored for 8 days before it was really determined that this animal is not leaving the pond. And so at that time, a decision group came together. It was NOAA and a bunch of other stranding organizations in our network to figure out the best course of action to remove him and get him out of the pond, which logistically was very challenging because he was an active, bright, four-year-old seal. He weighed about 250 pounds, and we tried to get in little Zodiac because he seemed to be interested in the boat when it was in the pond. Tried to collect him with a net, but it really was not working out for us. We kind of all grouped at the end of our first day of trying to capture Schubert out of the pond, and we decided to meet up the next morning at 6 a.m., and so at 4 in the morning, phone call came to my phone, and apparently Schubert had taken it upon himself to come out of the pond, and then he went straight to the police station, which, if you could see this on a map, it was not really near the pond. It's pretty incredible the route he took, but across this big parking lot all the way to this opposite end of this area, which is where the police station was. And the best part about the whole story is it's all on camera because all the stores had surveillance cameras on. So you can, there was some videos online of him undulating across this parking lot in front of all these shops. But the police have it on their camera as well, and an officer comes out. And as soon as Schubert sees the officer, he kind of turned around and went straight to a parking garage. But the police officers were able to corral him with some folding tables until Noah was able to arrive with a crate from Mystic up there that was large enough to hold an adult seal. So he was crated, and we brought him back to the aquarium just for about a day and a half or so to take radiographs and do a health assessment on him, to make sure he didn't ingest anything when he was in the pond and make sure he had the clean bill of health before releasing him. But the really great, cool thing about that case is that Schubert had a flipper tag, and his flipper tag matched up to a seal pup we had in 2018 that came from Cape Cod and came to us for a variety of ailments, including osteomyelitis, so a bone infection in the hind flipper. And we ended up having to amputate one of his digits, which was very minor, and he was able to be released after that. And he also had a big scar on the side of his face. So he was definitely identifiable by those features. So it was really neat to get to see an animal that we had released come full circle, because satellite tags for animals cost anywhere from like $5,000 to $6,000. And we can't satellite tag every animal we release. And most of the time, we don't really know what happens to the seals that we send off. So it was really nice to see how healthy he was and what a success his case had been. But we did satellite tag him, and he has taken a route that is a little more surprising, but he seems to really like the shoreline. He's pretty much gone to every single island off the coast in our coverage area throughout Massachusetts, and even in southern areas, gone to Delaware Bay area. So he has traveled all over.
What an amazing story. I love that, especially that everything was caught on camera.
Yes, Google it. It's one of the most amazing videos I've seen. It's the Schubert video.
Oh, what a great story. Not every story in rescue work always ends so happily. So it's nice to have animals like Schubert.
Absolutely. The data that we are going to get from that satellite tag is going to be really helpful in monitoring the local gray seal population. And so his case is a very important one and has a lot of scientific merit to it as well.
Amazing. Well, thank you for sharing such an inspirational story. And speaking of inspiration, you got inspired by doing some research and an internship, and now you've turned that into a career. So for those of our listeners who might be interested in following in your footsteps and doing something like this, what advice do you have for them?
Yeah, when I graduated college, I wasn't really sure where I wanted to go with my career or this field in general. And so what's helped me the most is just kind of applying to all sorts of different opportunities and taking whatever opportunities come my way, because I really think that not every opportunity is going to leave you feeling like this is exactly what I want to do, but it'll give you some sort of information or direction on where you want to go with your career. And after I graduated college, I moved to Australia for a year. And while I was there, I found an opportunity to volunteer at a wildlife hospital. And so I worked with kangaroos and all sorts of native species to Australia. And that was my first introduction into the medical side of the field. But after that, I decided to take other opportunities. I was in the marine mammal training field for many years, training a lot of different pinniped species and Hawaiian monk seals. I worked as an aquarist, which I knew at the time I didn't think was my ultimate career goal, but still that experience was fantastic. The people I met were amazing, and the knowledge I learned from that really helped shape my career. And with that job, I had learned all about the life support systems that we use for fish tanks. And now I'm working rehabilitating sea turtles and seals, and I have to be able to fix a broken pipe if something happens. And just knowing all the life support information just really helped me even in this aspect of my career. So you will learn something from every opportunity, whether it's your dream job. Ultimately, I don't think is the biggest takeaway. I just think it's the knowledge you gain from that job and how that's going to shape you and direct you to your ultimate career goal. And any opportunity you get, make the most of it. Just work really hard, and the people that you work with are going to help make that experience great. So just take every opportunity, because I'm sure it'll be fantastic in one way or another.
Great advice. And you're absolutely right. Well, Sarah, it was a pleasure having you share your stories here today on Aquadocs. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so great to chat with you again. Hopefully I'll see you again soon too.
Absolutely.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Sarah Callan for being on the show this week, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. Thank you to our sponsors, AAFE, the American Association of Fish Veterinarians, WAVMA, the World Aquatic Veterinary Medical Association, and the Cornell Wildlife Health Center for their continued support of Aquadocs. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please like and follow us on Apple and Spotify and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield-Feig, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.